Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. You're listening to episode 53 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Gary Habermas. Dr. Habermas is the author, co-author, or editor of more than 40 books, of which over 20 are on various aspects of Jesus' resurrection. He is also distinguished research professor at Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary, teaching in the PhD program, and he's the chair of the Department of Philosophy at Liberty University. In the 2017 volume 40, number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, he has written a feature article about the resurrection called Changing Attitudes Towards the Resurrection of Jesus. Gary, it's good to have you on.
Well, thank you. It's always glad to talk about this subject and good to talk to you, Mommy.
Well, you note in your article that the latest brand of criticism against the resurrection has shifted gears a bit, with critics now responding more frequently with what you're calling metacritiques. What is a metacritique?
Well, good question. I remember distinctly when I was proofreading the article in answer to a question or two of Eliot, I was thinking to myself, so what is a metacritique? I was asking myself that. I would distinguish it this way. In the old days, quote-unquote, which, you know, could be last week, but when people approached the resurrection in a way that they have for a long time, critics would often go after the New Testament accounts in what I would call a piecemeal manner. Like they might say, well, yeah, of course Jesus appeared to the disciples, but, you know, quote unquote, but if he didn't die on the cross, yeah, he could have appeared. So, you know, there's this tendency to kind of criticize one or two small elements and then try to make an excuse for accepting the rest of it. Now, that theory doesn't work. But what I mean is that's to go after something, a little tiny chunk of it, whereas a meta critique would maybe take the whole topic or the whole book in which we're talking about, let's say Luke, and say, here's my problem with what's going on here, and make this giant critique of everything instead of going after little details.
Can you tell us what are some of the natural responses to the resurrection that are found in the New Testament itself?
I make a comment in the article. It's a really interesting one, namely that if you just read the New Testament at face value, you know, good thing to do, there are about 5 suggested natural theories or alternative theories that say, yeah, well, Jesus didn't rise from the dead. What really happened was fill in the blank. And we think that's what critics do. But they do. But in the New Testament, you have 5 of those suggested, and they're the 5 major ones that come down through history, interesting again. And maybe even more interesting is that 3 of them are thought up by believers. So the 5 that are mentioned are that 2 different stolen body theories. One, the disciples did it, Matthew 28, the story of the guards at the tomb. Secondly, Mary Magdalene asks, not knowing it's Jesus, Mary Magdalene asks Jesus, are you the gardener? Did you move the body? So that's somebody else other than the disciples stole the body. You've got one is more like a guess. The New Testament does not suggest that Jesus did not die on the cross. However, when Pilate hears that Joseph of Arimathea wants to take the body, it says, and I like the King James here myself, Pilate says he marveled that he was so soon dead. He marveled that he died so quickly. And I guess, you know, for some people that would say, really? Is he already dead? But then the last 2, in Luke 24, we have they were terrified and frightened, the disciples, that is, and they thought they saw a ghost. And Jesus said, yeah, not so, because you can't touch a ghost. And then lastly, when the women first come to the disciples in Luke 24:10, they tell them the story about the tomb being empty and the body not being there. And very interestingly, in verse 11, it says the disciples thought they were idle tales. It's almost like, yeah, this is the kind of tale we would expect from you guys. You don't expect us to believe that, do you? So even the disciples there, and of course that's one of the examples of a believer having these questions, the disciples are wondering where they would get a story like this. How does that, you know, compute? So all five of the big ones are right there.
Yeah, you just mentioned that three of these theses in the New Testament were suggested by believers. Which ones were they? And then did they themselves doubt the resurrection?
Yes and yes. yeah, I just mentioned one of the three by believers, the disciples thinking the women were spreading quote-unquote idle tales. Then just the one I mentioned before that, also from the book of Luke, chapter 24, they thought Jesus might have been a ghost or some sort of disembodied spirit. I mean, like, you know, you might really be there, but you don't have a body, do you? And probably afraid to touch him, you know, when they're saying that. Or maybe even wonder if it was an hallucination, which we still hear prominently. And Mary is the third one, when Mary thinks Jesus is the gardener and says, please tell me where you've laid the body. So those are the three. And did they doubt? Yes. I mean, that's pretty explicit in, the Gospels make several comments about the doubting disciples, like I mentioned, thinking the women were spreading idle tales. But also in Matthew 28, verse 17, it says Jesus appeared to them in Galilee, which we may recall in Mark 14, 28. That's where Jesus tells the disciples ahead of time to meet him, and where the angel says the same thing in Mark 16. And they go there, and in verse 17 of Matthew 28, it says, some of them doubted. Now, there's been a lot of commentary on that word doubted in that context. There's many different words for doubt in the New Testament. It doesn't have to mean don't think it happened. It can mean just like, really? Is this what we think? Like when you go to an extraordinary event and some person you're waiting to see finally comes out on the stage and you go, is that him or her? Really? Sort of that kind of question. But yeah, they did ask questions.
Now, in your article, you say that many critical scholars concede that Jesus did miracles, at least in some sense. So why is that? Why would they concede that?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. You know, when I went to grad school, just to give you a little bit of a contrast, when I went to grad school in the mid-70s, if you spoke up in class and said that you believed that there was an empty tomb or that Jesus appeared bodily or that he was a miracle worker, probably your classmates would have concluded that you're either an evangelical or a conservative Roman Catholic, because that was the end of the Bultmann era, and they didn't talk like that. They didn't talk about evidences, and they didn't talk about miracles. Today, it's totally flip-flop. So between 1975 and, 40 years later, you've got to ask, what in the world's happened? And what's going on is the New Testament critics are bringing new criteria to the New Testament, the same kind of criteria historians apply to, say, Homer or some ancient book. And they say, well, one example would be the empty tomb looks pretty good, because why would you record women as being the first to record the empty tomb when that doesn't get you much mileage with men in the first century Mediterranean world? So that's called embarrassment. Well, because we have a lot of those sort of checks and balances, we can apply those same things to Jesus in the miracle accounts where he speaks Aramaic, which is usually believed to be his original language, or we have backup accounts, what's called multiple attestation, two heads are better than one, where you have backup on a single miracle. For example, the feeding the 5,000, by the way, is told in all four Gospels. And that's the only one that is, except for the resurrection. So I should add a footnote. Critics would only count that as two sources, by the way, because they think most of them think Matthew and Luke got it from Mark. So it would be Mark and John would be the two texts. But still, two heads are better than one, and that's two heads. So they would look at those things and they would say, yeah, well, there's some interesting evidence here that this kind of stuff went on. So there's been a total reevaluation today, and very close to 100% of critics think that the healing type stories in the Gospels, these same ones that the Gospels tell are ones just like them, were done by Jesus.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Gary Habermas, and in the 2017 Volume 40, Number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, he has written a feature article about the resurrection called Changing Attitudes Toward the Resurrection of Jesus. To read his article on the resurrection, please subscribe to the journal, and a 6-issue subscription is $39.50, and to subscribe, please go online and visit our website, equip.org. We're talking to Gary Habermas about the resurrection. So why should people accept that Jesus predicted his own resurrection? Could that have been added later?
Yeah, another good question. And that's in the genre of the one you just asked about the miracles, because that's another event. If I had sat there in class in 1975 and said, yeah, you know, Jesus predicted the resurrection, people look at me like, ah, so you believe in a supernatural world, right? But once again, the same sorts of checks and balances that critics are applying to the miracle accounts or to the empty tomb accounts, they are also applying to the predictions of the resurrection. For example, we have, you know, quote unquote, two heads are better than one. We have backup testimony for these. Some of the predictions are Son of Man context, and Son of Man is very highly accredited among critics that really is a way that Jesus spoke. And one thing that's interesting about that is it was Jesus' favorite title for himself, Son of Man, and yet it is not given as a title for Jesus in any of the New Testament epistles, which seems to say that it was his private name for himself. So it's in those contexts that he says, I'm going to die and I'm going to come back. An embarrassing context, Peter speaks up and says, no way, I'll go to death with you. And Jesus said, not really, you're going to deny me. That's very embarrassing. Why would one of the two or three biggest names in the early church have abandoned his Lord? So those sorts of criteria are the things that critics look for to say, this text looks pretty firm, and the predictions just make it the same way with those standards.
You talked about the empty tomb accounts. What are some of the critical grounds on which the empty tomb is actually accepted as history today?
You know what? You're hitting some real home runs here, Melanie. That fits into the exact same category as the miracle working Jesus, the predicting of his resurrection Jesus, and now the empty tomb. Back to my 70s make-believe graduate class, if I had said empty tomb, they would have said, wow, where do you go to church? You know, maybe not so complimentary a fashion. But I gave a lecture before a group of scholars just about a year and a half ago, and the lecture was on using critical criteria only. In other words, treating the Gospels the way critics treat the Gospels. We have more than 20 different reasons to believe the tomb was empty. 20. And you think, wow, I don't remember that much stuff in the New Testament. But that's the kind of things that emerge when you apply some of these rules. And I already gave one. If you're one of four authors writing the four Gospels, we forget these fellows didn't live next door to each other. They were situated around the Mediterranean. Why would they all give the account that the women were the first ones to find the empty tomb if using women as witnesses wouldn't get you a lot of mileage in the ancient world? Now, I will correct one thing we hear today. Women could testify in a Jewish court of law, but if there were men, you would always use male testimony. And, you know, the more important, the more you really want to use men. So why do all four of these guys start with women? And by the way, two of the Gospels, Luke and John, they both say that men ran back to the tomb to check it out. Why not start your story with the men going back to the tomb? Why tell the previous story of the women being there? And the answer to that is, we're trying to tell the truth, and that's just truth. Well, that reason, we're trying to tell the truth, even if it doesn't get us very far with you, that's a good reason to believe they are indeed telling the truth. So the women, is by far the most common reason that critics give. And the second one is, if you're going to think Jesus rose from the dead, say it happened in Rome. If you're just, I mean, if you're just making up the Gospels, like a lot of critics think, you know, say he rose from the dead in Rome, or say he was seen in Rome, but don't say Jerusalem. Why not? Well, because a Sunday afternoon stroll down the road, you could stop by the tomb if you wanted to, do a little bit of research, find out where he was buried, see the stones roll back. The place is open. No other person's been put in there. We're told it was empty prior to Jesus, so probably nothing, probably nobody would be there, you know, 2 weeks later. And that Sunday afternoon stroll would reveal to you that the tomb is empty, still empty. So why Jerusalem? Don't tell me the tomb is empty in Jerusalem unless the tomb is really empty in Jerusalem, because there are thousands of people who can check it out. And one more thing I would add, some critics try to outguess evangelicals, and they'll say, well, look, even your book, they mean Acts chapter 1, even your book says that the early Christians didn't preach the resurrection for 50 days, i.e. Pentecost. By that time, you wouldn't be able to identify the body in the tomb. And I think that kind of criticism misses the whole point. We didn't say, the Gospels didn't say, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John didn't say, there was a body in the tomb, but it wasn't Jesus because he was not recognizable. They said the tomb was empty. So unless the tomb is empty, they are disproven. A messed-up corpse is still not empty, and they can only proclaim empty without a body there. So those are the two best reasons, I think, the women and the city of Jerusalem.
Your article notes that even most scholars today accept the historicity of Jesus' appearance after death. In what sense do they accept this?
Yeah, that's good, because that's in the article, in your journal. And even when I was proofreading, I was thinking, boy, I wished I had some more time to explain this. It's not an easily understood comment, but I need to make a distinction here that I hope your listeners understand. I wrote an article some years ago when I said the majority of scholars today think that Jesus was raised from the dead in some sense. Now, what does some sense mean? Well, the New Testament sense is that he appeared bodily, and that when the disciples tried to touch him, presumably they did. By the way, Ignatius, just a couple decades after Luke wrote his gospel, Ignatius said they thought they saw a ghost. Jesus extended his hands and so on, and they touched him. We do find that. But some people believe, some scholars believe, this is a popular view half a century ago, and there's still a fair number of scholars around who hold this, that Jesus really did appear to his disciples, but in a non-bodily manner. And the way they go after that is to say, you know what, how Paul saw Jesus on the way to Damascus, Acts 9:22 and 26. That was sort of a glorified Jesus who blinded Paul. That's what all the appearances were like. So, and I think it's just the wrong notion. But my point is, they would believe that Jesus was really raised from the dead, but without a body. And if you put together the more popular view that Jesus was raised in a real body with the less popular view, all the appearances were like Paul's on the way to Damascus, that combination, because they both believe Jesus was raised, even those who say not bodily say he was really there. So you put those two together, and the vast majority of scholars say one or the other happened to Jesus. Now, I want to make plain, in my many, many publications on the resurrection, I really go after that view that says Jesus appeared in a non-bodily manner. But at this point in the journal article, I'm only making the point that if you combine the two groups, because they both answer the question, was Jesus really raised, they both say yes. That figure in my survey that I presented in a published chapter in a book, it actually comes to about 75%. So it's 75% say yes and 25% say no. That's a pretty good sized majority.
Why do critics sometimes claim that it's prejudice that we quote verses from the New Testament? What do they have against it?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the main 2 points in the article, so I appreciate you bringing that up. Usually, I want to make clear, usually the people who do that, they are not scholars. At least, I mean, they could have a PhD, but it could in a different field, a field that's not relevant. You know, you could be a PhD in electrical engineering. But people in the field, let's say Bart Ehrman, best-known critic in North America, he calls himself an agnostic leaning toward atheism. Bart Ehrman, if you don't quote the New Testament, he will quote it over and over and over and over. You go, well, then why doesn't he believe? Well, it's sort of like the old story of the spider, you know. Why didn't the spider get caught in his own web? Well, because he knows what strands of the web to walk on and what strands of the web not to walk on. Well, Bart Ehrman is only going to quote the New Testament strands that are evidenced, like what I was saying earlier. The women wouldn't have gone to the tomb. It's the city of Jerusalem. They emphasize, critics emphasize the texts that are demonstrable. And so Bart Ehrman's going to use Scripture right and left. He could care less if you use Scripture. In fact, if you don't, if you're an evangelical and you're trying to make a case, Bart might say, why are you shying away from the New Testament? But it's the non-specialists who say, that's not fair. You're quoting your own book. So therefore, it's a circular argument because you're assuming the book to quote the book. And I would point out that they're not using the text critically right there. That's a very uncritical use. In fact, Bart Ehrman wrote a book called Did Jesus Exist? And he writes against those people who don't know what they're talking about. And he says, you know, you guys would be better off if you used the text critically and don't just say whatever comes to your mind. So while that's a very common critique that you guys unfairly use the New Testament, there's an answer to that. Fairly use the New Testament. Use it fairly. Use the best passages to make your point, not the worst passages.
You mentioned that sometimes somebody who has a PhD, maybe say in electrical engineering, is addressing the resurrection. Why in the world would these types of people be trying to address the resurrection outside of their own field?
Well, great question. I hate to make an analogy that probably will bug somebody, but why do people get involved in politics who don't have any idea what they're talking about? Why are the guests sometimes on political talk shows out of the area? Because everybody has an opinion on things like religion and politics and what makes good music. They have opinions. They'll tell you who their favorite 60s or 80s artists are, and they don't have any training in music. So everybody likes to have a view, and if you feel very strongly about it, like politics or religion, just look what's going on today. If you have a very strong view, yeah, you don't care if people think you're telling the truth or you have any right to say or not, you're going to say it. And so a lot of these people, I think, I hate to say it, I really do, but a lot of these folks who are against Christian message and they're atheists and so on, they're not all like this, but there is in a lot of cases, there's an anger that's very near the surface, and again, that we see in politics today. So I kind of think that's why they're jumping in. They're jumping in because they don't care if you like their opinion or not. They feel strongly about this, and some people don't like the gospel message.
Finally, I'd like to ask you, how do you answer the charge that there's no supernatural realm? In other words, this is just fairy tales.
Yeah. That's good. You know, I've been starting lectures recently, and because I give lectures on near death experiences sometimes. It's sort of why would you do that? That's not part of the biblical worldview, but it is really, because what we're trying to do is establish that there's a supernatural realm, and if there's an afterlife of some kind, then a critic ought to listen to me when I'm talking about the resurrection, which is a very specific kind of afterlife. Well, so I'll start out a lecture and I'll say something like this. What if Narnia is really true? What if there really is a Middle Earth? What if, like Book 7, The Last Battle, and C.S. Lewis's Narnia, what if someday we are going to go to, quote-unquote, Narnia? Or what if someday we turn that last bend in the road, as a famous philosopher once said in an article, and we do see the Emerald City of Oz? What if in our experience that day comes, and Christians believe it will? I just think there's a lot of evidence for the supernatural realm, for Oz, if you will, for Narnia, for Middle Earth. And they're metaphors, or they're, you know, that's fantasy. But it really exists. And one of the ways I do that is to talk about, you know, you've had Michael Sabon before write a couple excellent articles in the Christian Research Journal before. Mike's a good friend of mine. And those are really good articles. And they kind of break the ice because they tell people, yeah, let's be careful. This supernatural realm can be kind of tricky, but there is a supernatural realm out there, and that's how I would go after it. I would use an icebreaker, things like God's existence or near-death experiences, or how about intelligent design or fine-tuning? Those are all, to me, pointers that the supernatural world really exists.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Gary. So, Gary, it's your last meal of your life. What would you want to eat?
Meal. Okay. Breakfast. I mean, it doesn't have to be breakfast as in the morning, but breakfast food. I'd have a hard time choosing between fried eggs, scrambled eggs, and an omelet, but some form of eggs and bacon and maybe an English muffin. How's that?
Are you an early bird or a night owl?
Well, I would have said I'm a night owl until just recently, but I stay up till anywhere between 1 and 3 o'clock every morning. So that makes me a night owl. But because I'm doing a magnum opus on the resurrection, actually 3,000 or more pages, 4 volumes on the resurrection, like this morning I got up at 7:30. So I've been burning the candle at both ends. So can you be 2 owls at once?
I guess so. 3:30 in the morning, that's pretty late.
Yeah, I think this morning was 1:30 to 7:30. So it was 6 hours. So I had to do with that.
This past summer, did you go on vacation? And if you did, where did you go?
Yes. Well, we went to the beach with all the kids. All of our children were invited, but only 3 of them went. And we went to the beach in the Outer Banks in North Carolina, and we were there for a week. And your listeners might be interested in this. My wife and I have vacationed with Mike Lacona and his wife, Debbie, 21 Labor Days in a row that we've done this without a miss. So that's the second little week of vacation.
Wow. Well, thanks, Gary, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
I enjoyed it, Molly. Thank you very much.
Today's guest is Dr. Gary Habermas, and in the 2017 Volume 40, Number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, he has written a feature article about the resurrection called Changing Attitudes Toward the Resurrection of Jesus. To read his article, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is $39.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram, and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and we'd love it if you'd rate and review our podcast. Also, please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's new audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast. Here are my answers to this episode's rapid-fire questions. The last meal of my life would be a favorite of mine, which is Japanese noodle soup, a specific one called tempura udon. I am an early bird. I get up really early, before 5 a.m. so that I can work out by 5:30 a.m. And yes, this summer I did go on vacation, and it was a one-day trip to Atlanta to see the Andy Warhol exhibit and also to eat some great food there.